This was the early shaping of an American patriot, and, for Wilson, just the beginning of a lifetime fascination with war, weapons, public service, and something else. A curious conviction that didn't come to him all at once, but grew with greater and greater force and clarity as the war unfolded, and the voices over the radio began to deliver a separate message to Charlie. As time went on, he would come to feel that one day his would be the voice on the radio. Wilson's father was an accountant for the timber company. They had little money, but were better off than most people in town. They lived in a pleasant house and were pillars of their community. Charles Edwin Wilson had almost known despair when the mill closed down during the Depression and he was laid off. But the next day he had signed on with Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal jobs program, the Civilian Conservation Corps, where he worked as a roads supervisor, intensely proud of the fact that he had never missed a day's work. Wilson's father had one fixed ambition for his son, to attend the U.S. Naval Academy. He insisted it would be a ticket to success. And so he lobbied his local congressman and, after two tries, got his son an appointment to Annapolis. Charlie flunked the first test because he was so scrawny. The second he passed only after wolfing down 15 bananas to bring his 6-foot-4-inch body up to the Academy's 140-pound minimum. In September 1952, Wilson's proud parents drove their boy to Houston in the family's new Chevrolet and put him on a TWA flight for his trip across the country. Wilson remembers his first plane ride on the propeller-driven Constellation, which delivered him to the start of his military career. Wilson and his fellow midshipmen in the starting class of 2000 were warned that less than half of them would graduate, and over the years, it was always touch and go whether Charlie would make the cut. He was a classic military screw-up, constantly reprimanded for talking in formation, not having his shoes shined, leaving his light on after curfew. But somehow he made it through, in 1956 graduating 8th from the bottom of his class, with the distinction of having more demerits than any other graduate in anyone's memory. Because of Annapolis, Wilson missed Korea. But at 25, as a gunnery officer on a destroyer sailing the world with the American fleet at the height of the Cold War, he felt that he was at last coming into his own. He was in command of the warship's weapons, and his gunnery teams almost always won the mock battles, in part because he had his men practice more than anyone else. They always ran out of ammunition long before they could get back to their home port to be resupplied. Wilson did this to sharpen his men's skills, but also to empty the ammo boxes so that he could fill them with cheap alcohol bought on shore leave in Gibraltar to smuggle back to the States. Wilson's training style was unconventional, but he ended up with the happiest men and the best shots in the fleet. Wilson was now feeling the power of America, moving about sometimes with the entire U.S. Atlantic fleet and other times with NATO naval units. "We were undisputedly the kings of the world, and everybody knew it. We were arrogant sons of bitches, but they loved us." He sailed everywhere in those years, to Athens, Marseille, Naples, Karachi, Beirut, and everywhere he went he felt proud. America was rebuilding Europe through the Marshall Plan, the dollar was powerful, and there was more than a woman in every port for the smiling, open-faced, fun-loving young officer in the starched white uniform. There were also long stretches of downtime at sea that Wilson put to good use, reading all of Churchill's wartime books, consuming each as they came out, and moving on to biographies of Roosevelt and George Kennan's prescription for dealing with communism. From his destroyer on Christmas morning, 1956, he wrote to his parents and kid sister, evoking the same spirit that had led the young boy to keep vigil at his bedroom window in Trinity, scanning the sky for enemy Messerschmitts. "Dear Mother, Daddy, and Sharon, it's now 5:15 a.m., Christmas morning. I have the 4-to-8 watch, so I am up bright and early, as always, on Christmas. This will be my third duty day in a row, as I am standing by for some of the married fellows so they can be with their families. This business of being away from home today is certainly not by choice, but neither is it something without reason. I can console myself, and I hope you too, by simply realizing that we are doing a job here that must be done. It is only through constant vigilance on the part of the few that a secure, peaceful Christmas can be enjoyed by many." These read like lines for a Jimmy Stewart character, but the sentiments were very much Wilson's own. In later life, he would usually disguise such nakedly idealistic thoughts. That letter, however, without any hint of self-consciousness, is key to understanding Wilson's later compulsion to be the lone cowboy sounding the alert, mobilizing the forces of freedom. Patrolling the seas during those Cold War years, Wilson came personally to feel the menace and reach of Soviet power. His destroyer spent most of its time chasing the Soviet submarines that hounded the fleet. The destroyers purposefully badgered them with mock attacks, forcing them under for days on end. The great triumph would come when, after 2 or 3 days of pursuit, a sub would finally be forced to surface. The Americans would snap photos of the disgraced Russians and give them the finger, while the enemy would shake their fists in return. "I always kept my depth charges on total alert," Wilson recalls with bravado. On more than one occasion, the young gunnery officer appealed to the ship's captain to permit him to blast one of the subs. "I promised a clean kill," Wilson recalls. "Nobody would have ever known what happened to the fuckers, but they wouldn't let me do it." After 3 years at sea chasing Russian submarines, Wilson was assigned to a top-secret post at the Pentagon, where he was part of an intelligence unit that evaluated the Soviet Union's nuclear forces. Having chased Soviet submarines, he now found himself rehearsing for all-out nuclear war. Back then, the U.S. response time to an incoming Soviet nuclear attack was 35 minutes. There were frequent simulated attacks, and Charlie often stood in for the top generals, who had only 7 minutes to dive into waiting helicopters to be flown to the Rock, the secret underground bunker carved into a Maryland mountain. "I would be sitting there where the button is, and if you're 27, it makes you feel very cocky knowing that here's Moscow and here's Kiev, and if they fuck with us, I'll just hit all these buttons." In spite of his bravado, the experience was sobering. Day after day, he confronted the reality of an enemy he knew was rehearsing America's nuclear destruction, and he resented it. It became a lifelong obsession to bring down this evil power, and all of his idealism and patriotic passions, which had been building since childhood, suddenly found an inspirational outlet when John Kennedy launched his campaign for the presidency. Kennedy appealed to every aspect of the young naval officer's imagination. A war hero, he was a dashing, handsome idealist, rallying the country to greatness and making it all look like fun. After work each day, hours spent studying the Soviet intercontinental ballistic missile threat, Wilson would rush from the Pentagon to the Kennedy campaign headquarters where he volunteered. Like so many others of his generation, Wilson became caught up in the aura of romance that Kennedy lent to public service. It's not legal for active duty servicemen to campaign for public office, but Wilson decided to disregard that detail. He took 30 days leave from the Navy and entered his name in the race for Texas State Representative. Tall and skinny, always dressed in a suit, Wilson ran his campaign in East Texas the way the Kennedys had made famous in Massachusetts. His mother, his sister, and all their friends went door to door selling the idea of Charlie as a fresh, new idea in Texas politics. He won, and managed to complete his Pentagon tour without anyone noticing his entry into the political arena. In 1961, at 27, he was sworn into office in Austin, Texas, the same month his political role model became the 35th President of the United States.